Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
On this episode of Narcissist Apocalypse, we talk with an abuse survivor named Simon, and Simon was raised by an emotionally stunted narcissistic father. It's a story of fear, identity issues, low self-everything, and family adoption secrets. Welcome to Narcissist Apocalypse, everyone. This is a podcast that gives a voice to survivors of toxic relationships. I am Brandon Chadwick, but my friends call me Chad, and thanks for tuning into this episode. So what is a narcissist, you may ask? Well, for the purposes of this podcast, we refer to a narcissist as anyone who has displayed a pattern of behavior that shows a limited capacity to appreciate others' perspectives. It is that simple. And now, before we get to our episode with Simon, I first want to thank everyone in the Narcissist Apocalypse community for listening to the show and sharing your thoughts by email, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Also, a reminder, if you have not left us a review on whatever podcast service you use, Spotify, Apple, Google, Stitcher, CastBox, etc., please leave us a 5-star written review, as it helps out the show a lot when it comes to rankings. Now, if you have not been to our website recently and want to be a part of our show, go to our website at narcissistapocalypse.com. Top of the page, there's a button that says guest form. Fill out that guest form and we will go from there. But another way to be on our show is to also go to narcissistapocalypse.com and to read a letter to your narcissist. On the side of the page, there's a floating button that says send voicemail. Click on that button. It records up to 5 minutes. You press it twice, records up to 10. Read your letter to your narcissist, but if you don't want to do it yourself, you want to send it to me or my old pal Melissa to read, send it to narcissistapocalypse@gmail.com and put letters to my narcissist in the subject line. And what else do we have here? Other things on our site. We are offering high conflict parenting courses that can be found at narcissistapocalypse.com/courses. Yes, we have partnered with online parenting, and many of the courses we are offering were created by Bill Eddy. And if you've listened to our episode last year with divorce lawyer named Helen, you'll know that Bill Eddy is an expert in dealing with these individuals in court. And now he's helped create many parenting courses to help you through divorce and to help support your children too. These courses are the most widely recognized courses by family courts across the country. So if you want to support the show and are looking for guidance, please do go to narcissistapocalypse.com/courses. And our Patreon, everyone, if you want to support the show, become a member of our Patreon. Yes, we have a Patreon where you can hear episodes that never made it to air, episodes with former guests, much more. And what is that much more? We now have virtual support groups every Wednesday and Saturday. It's a good group of people on there. Hello to everyone who is there on Saturday night. And we also have our own little forum board on there as well, so people can communicate with each other. That's at patreon.com/narcissistapocalypse if you want to support this show. And that's pretty much it. This episode with Simon is a really interesting episode. You know, we discussed a lot of different things here, including nature versus nurture. You'll find out a lot about the adopted sibling that he finds out he has when he's about 42 years old. There's a lot kind of to unpack here. It's an emotional episode. It's a lot of learning that you can get through this one as well. I really just want to thank Simon for being part of it. Also, at the beginning, I tried to explain everything In my recording with Simon, and it didn't really go very well. It just became more confusing because there's a lot of players in the story. I've re-recorded it after the fact on my end, so you'll hear that. There might be a sound difference when that happens, and then the rest of the show will continue. So now that's just my little bit of warning of my many warnings that I usually have before, and that is it. So everyone, without further ado, here is my episode with Simon. Welcome to Narcissist Apocalypse, everyone. With me today, I have Simon. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Brandon. How are you?
I'm doing well, and we talked a couple weeks ago, and now we are back here. And we had to re-record this part because I made the story more confusing than it really was. So just to explain to everyone the players that we have in this story before we go forward, we have Simon, we have his mother and his father, and then Simon has three sisters. There is one that is 16 years older than him, and that is his half-sister who's been in his life the whole time. And then you have one sister who is, I think it is 7 years older than him, and that person is his full sister. However, she was adopted out of the family. And then you have a sister that is 6 years older than him, which is also his full sister, that lived with him his whole life. And you'll find out within this story that they all didn't find out that they had this adopted sister, or who was adopted out, until 3 years ago. So now that that is explained, you'll probably hear some conversation later on as if the mess up did happen. But anyway, without further ado and getting in your way here, here is the rest of the story.
Okay, so my father and my father, who is the narcissist in this story, grew up in a very an abusive family home. And he has got two sisters and three brothers, all of which suffered a lot of physical abuse at home, and there was also some sexual abuse as well, parental abuse. And my father left home, I think, when he was 14 years old, and went out to live his life, basically getting various jobs. He worked as a lorry driver for many years, and he was a lorry driver's mate for the first couple of years that he had left home. And he was driving lorries in Britain, age 15, while the guy who should have been driving slept in the back.
For us in North America, what is a lorry?
Oh, it's a truck.
Okay, thank you.
Like an articulated truck. So it's one of the big ones, you know, not a small one, not a van. And he, so that's his kind of background. They all had a very, very difficult relationship with their father and their mother as well, who was, although the story has changed now over the past kind of 20 or 30 years since she's died, she's become more of a kind of, she's been redeemed in the stories of the family, I think, somewhat from the person that she was when she was alive and what they all thought of her then. But he never was redeemed. My dad's father, they all pretty much, I think, the girls didn't have as much animosity towards him and hatred of him than the boys, but it was incredibly dysfunctional, and all in their own ways. My father and his siblings are pretty out there. They're all successful. None of them are dead. Considering their background and the stuff that kind of has happened to them when they were children, but they're all kind of odd in their own ways. And but my father is a narcissist and is Basically, he met my mother after she had already been married before to a man who she met when she was 15 years old. And this was in the early 60s. Actually, I think she met him in 1959. And then she was 15 years old when she met her first husband. She fell pregnant, which at the time was appalling in Britain. It was an incredibly shameful thing to happen in a kind of working class community that she lived in. So she had the child, not with the blessing of her mum and dad, but they didn't give the child up for adoption. And my mother was incredibly shamed by it, and her family were also incredibly shamed by this. And my mother tells it that basically she wasn't allowed out of the house for 5 years after the baby was born because of the shame of it. Pushing the pram down the street, to be seen doing that at her age would have just been awful. And the man that she married was a dog that she got pregnant by and was forced to marry, he turned out to be an alcoholic, but he wasn't an alcoholic. He was a heavy drinker then, but later on in his life, he became very addicted to alcohol. But he left basically after a year. So she moved out of her mother's house when she was 16. The baby was born when she was 16. This is the first baby. And then they lived alone together for a year, and then he walked out. So she had to go back and live with her mother and father. As I said, she would then basically was kept in the house for 4 years, 4 or 5 years. And when the baby was old enough, my eldest sister said, I was allowed out. She wasn't literally kept in the house. That makes it sound like she was locked up. But it was a shameful thing. She could go out to work, but she had her life restricted by the shame of this, basically, this event. Anyway, when the baby was about five, she was allowed to go out and live her life again. And she met my father, who at a night in some sort of place in where she lived. And they went away together for what we would call in Britain a dirty weekend. And they went to a seaside resort in the north of England just for 2 nights to stay. And this is, bear in mind, this is the first person our mother had spent a lot of time with in about 5 years. Anyway, on that first weekend they went away, she got pregnant again. So she came home from that event, walked, still living with her mother and father, and discovered that she had a child. And you can imagine the shock of it for her mum and dad. They were... it was horrifying for them, basically. And when my dad found out that they were pregnant, he didn't want anything to do with the child. That has come out since, but that's not how my mother tells it. But
we'll get to that.
We'll get to that. Yeah. So So she, when she was started showing, they shipped her off to I don't know what you'd call it, but it was a home for fallen women, I suppose. But she spent
if I remember correctly, it's a place with nuns.
Yes, it was. It was a religious order of nuns.
And she's being put there until this blows over, pretty much.
Yeah. Until the baby is born and they can decide what to do with it, so that she doesn't have to walk down the street with another pregnant belly, I suppose, would be the reason that they did that. And that she could then come back having had the baby and nobody would ever know that she'd been pregnant again.
Because at this point for your mom, what is happening is here, she's already felt like she shamed her family once. And now here's this second instance where... they're not married.
Yes, they're not married. No chance for that.
And at this point, she doesn't want to do any shameful thing again, and she goes and into hiding until they can kind of figure it out. And the child that is born is actually the your eldest sister, full sister, but we'll call her your adopted full sister, and that's how her adoption came to be.
Yes, that's right. So she, the child was given up for adoption eventually and went to live down the road. It was, but we didn't know this, of course. We didn't know any of this at all. My father disappeared off the scene, and my mum just went back to her normal life. The baby was gone. My dad wasn't there. But then, 3 years later, please, I mean, if these dates don't work out, it's because I'm forgetting ages and things like that. I'm sorry. But yeah, 3 years later it would be. My dad came back. And my mother was a very attractive woman. Is a very attractive woman, and she was very good looking when she was younger, and my dad a lot less so. But he has since told me that she was a trophy. You know, he would never have got anyone that good looking who wasn't broken, essentially a broken human being. And so he saw an opportunity. He didn't say this to me. This is what I imagine happened. He saw an opportunity. He'd been gone for 3 years. He came back and said, how about we try and make a go of it? And they did. They tried to make a go of it. And then my other sister was born, the sister who is 6 years older than me. And they moved in together next to my grandmother, my mother's mother, in the house literally next door.
6 years older than you or 16 years older than you?
Oh, 6 years older than me. She's 6 years older than me. Yeah. This one that was born was 6 years older than me. So my dad came back.
Okay.
So at this point, my mother had the eldest half. The adopted child had gone and been adopted out. And then they had another child who is the sister just above me, who is 6 years older than me. So he came back. She was born, the sister just above me, 6 years old. And then eventually I was born. And we lived in absolute kind of, we didn't know that the child existed. This was never, ever spoken about, that this child had been adopted out, ever. And 3 years ago, we discovered somebody got in contact with the sister just above me, my 6 year old. But the sister who's just above me, 6 years older than me, and she, somebody got in contact with her and said, I think we might be related. And my sister said, she phoned me and said, this person has just got in contact with me on Facebook and said that it might be related to her. And I've looked, have a look at her Facebook profile. And she didn't say at that point, you're my sister. She just said, I think we might be related. And we both went onto Facebook and looked at this woman's profile. And the moment that we opened Facebook, it was obvious that she was related to us in a very close way, because she looks identical. She looks absolutely identical to my sister, who's to my full sister.
So before we get to the whole story of meeting your full sister, let's go into your life with your other sisters and what you kind of had to deal with when it comes to you growing up, you know, with your story. You know, you can obviously tell a bit of your sister's story as well. How did it all kind of begin where you knew that something was off?
With my dad?
Yeah.
Well, so he, from my very earliest memories, was a incredibly unstable person. He acted a lot. He would absolutely fly off the handle at the smallest slights. He had to have every single thing exactly as he wanted it. Otherwise, he just wouldn't tolerate it, basically. He would he'd get angry. He would get irritated, constantly irritated if things weren't exactly as he wanted them to be all the time. He didn't seem to have any compunction at all to make things in any way better for anyone else apart from himself. So he was a fundamentally selfish person. He and when I was very small, I mean, I don't remember a lot. We've kind of, as a family, me and the two sisters that I grew up with, we've attempted to kind of construct a kind of what he was like then, because, you know, you forget. It's that's what the past is, isn't it, as well? It's a kind of patchwork that you constantly kind of attempt to kind of keep together and understand is there. But I remember from when I was very young being I was terrified of him. I was very, very frightened of him. And my primary memories from an early age is of fear and of having my mother pull me away from situations that could potentially, now, of course, I know, I could irritate him, or I would, you know, confront him. And children are, I've got two small children myself, and they are just, I mean, sometimes the amount of noise, he cannot stand noise. He can't stand, and not being the center of attention. Over the years, I've realized that is a huge thing for him, is having children there and no one is looking at him. It's, that's just one of the reasons. But another reason is that, of course, children who are noisy distract him from the things that he wants to do. He needs the space for himself. He doesn't need these children under his feet all the time. And but being moved away from situations by my mother, being taken out of rooms when he's flown off the handle and shouted or, you know, screamed that he wants things changed. Particularly that fear came when he used to come home from work, because I think he often did jobs that he didn't like. And he would come home and I remember being frightened of what would happen when he came home, because you just didn't know whether he'd had a good day or a bad day. Most of the time he'd had a bad day, because he would come home and things had to be exactly correct. And if things weren't exactly correct, then a tiny thing could make him go, you know. And he was physically violent with my eldest sister, and he was physically violent with me as well. But I wouldn't say that I had I was beaten or anything like that. He used to, the vast majority of the time, what I was terrified of was rage, absolute rage. And he used to scream at me through his teeth. So he would grit his teeth and come up incredibly close to my face when I was small and, you know, scream at, you know, just be so angry, like, you know, what a gorilla's like when it's raging. Like that. And it's just terrifying me, you know, just terrified.
So you're a young child, you're dealing with your dad, who is the type of narcissist who, no matter what is going on, needs the attention on him. Yeah. He's one of them that is jealous of the children because he wants your mom's attention. Yes. And he demands your mom's attention over your mom taking care of you guys.
Yes.
And when you're dealing with this at a small age, or at a younger age here, what are the first survival techniques in your personality that you start to change to make your life easier? Or are you acting out, which then makes your life even harder? And before I leave off right there for you to answer, you know, you have a sister that is 6 years older, and then you have your sister who is a lot older.
Yeah.
You know, they're maybe, I don't know if your oldest, the eldest one is still in the home, maybe when you're
five. She left about 18, I think. So she was there for a good, for 2 years, then she came back for another couple of years. So she was around a lot, you know.
So you're all getting it. So you're all in the same boat. How are they caring for you? And do you at least feel the love of them?
This is very difficult to say and to kind of talk about, really, because it's not, it is for them, it's entirely blameless. I don't want to apportion any blame or anything like that, or paint them to be difficult or, you know, nasty human beings, because both of them aren't at all. We all were in it together, and it didn't separate us growing up in this house at all. The opposite happened. It was so obvious and so difficult that we came together against him. And there was no competing for his affections. In the early days. I always said that my dad was the biggest child in the house, and he is. He's like an 8-year-old, and that is his emotional state is like an like that of a 7 or 8-year-old child. And one thing I wanted to kind of point out on doing this is just how, you know, those aren't just kind of abstract words. He really is like that. You know, it is comical how narcissistic he is, and how overt his narcissism is, and how just when you see it and you understand what he's doing, just it's baffling that he can not he doesn't see it. He has no perception that what he does is wrong. Because there is something missing inside of him. There's something not there. There's a something that he was never given as a child, or you know, this ideal self that he is constantly creating. It happens 24 hours of every day, and it's you know. Anyway, that's what I wanted to point out. But when I was very small, I think my father has told me since that he resented me being born because I was I've said this to you before, Randall, but in a moment of kind of enlightened thought, when he was trying to curry my favor, he said, I resented you. You were a boy. And when you were born, you were taking, literally said, you were taking affections away from me. And so that must have been difficult for me, I think he said, or something like that. It was difficult for me. You don't know how difficult that, just something along those lines, which I just, anyway. But he would be aggressive towards me, I imagine, in those times, because he's always said to me my whole life, you were a weed. You were a weedy child. You were a mummy's boy. You were always a mummy's boy. And of course, thinking about it now with kind of some information about who he is as a person, when your male child is born for a narcissist, he would see this as an opportunity to, you know, me to be another him, or for me to just kind of, he could live his life through me in some way. I don't know. I would make him proud, or make him proud of himself, of what he's achieved, of what he's done. Look what I've done. Look at my lovely son. You know. But I immediately came out and was probably terrified by his rage and retreated from him. And my mother, of course, stepped in and, in his words, coddled me. So I was coddled and made soft and by my mother. So that must have enraged him even more, because in his view, I was being taken away from him, and she was restricting access to me and not giving me the opportunity to come and love him, I suppose. But as a matter of fact, that was because I was utterly terrified of him and who he is as a person. But what my primary things that I remember from that time are, as I say, being taken out of rooms. My mother was, I think she was a slightly different person to the person that she is now. She's very much institutionalized into the relationship. They've been married for 50 years. But at the time, she was a bit more spunky, I suppose. she didn't necessarily stand up for herself. She appeased, constantly appeased 24 hours a day, did what he wanted and made him not explode. But she was very kind to me, and she tried to do her best, I suppose, to try and keep me away from him. I remember just being quiet. I used to shut up a lot and not say anything, and just go out of the room, try not to be in the room when everyone was in there, basically just become as small as possible. And my sisters, I think, were more, especially the one that's 6 years older than me, that just above me, she got the golden child treatment more, if anybody did, she did, because she was his first child. She was very capable. She's a very capable person. She's very intelligent. And he would have seen a lot more to kind of himself, is his, the self that he wants to be in her. So she was a doer. She did lots of, she got a scholarship to a very, very good private school that they put her into when she was eight. She passed all the exams. She studied for a year because they didn't have the money to put her in, but she got a scholarship. And, you know, she used to do lots of things and she was active. But I've always called her, I have called her in the past in times of rage, his little brown shirt. They both were, you know, they used to tease me kind of on, not necessarily at his behest, but because maybe he found it funny or it was a fun thing to do. So it was, but of course what they were trying to do was get into his good books, you know. Yeah, that's that.
And so as you got older, I assume your sister leaves the home. So now you're there by yourself. Yeah. And mm-hmm. at that point, how does the relationship devolve from there? How are you acting? And in that era of, you know, from, I guess, you know, 12 and upwards, mm-hmm. how are yeah. you surviving?
I was completely avoidant is how I'm surviving. They used to call me the lurker. So I used to come to the doors and just peek around the door, see the people in the room, check it out, what was happening. And I just used to kind of slowly move away. I hated spending any time with groups. As if my father was involved, certainly I couldn't sit in a room with him. I still can't sit in a room with him. I find it absolutely intolerable. But it was when I was 11 years old. So my dad quit his job when I was about nine, and he decided to sell to, we had quite a big garden at the time, and he decided to make our garden 1/10 of the size and to build a house in the garden. That was his dream. That's what he was going to do. And my mother desperately didn't want him to do it, but he did it anyway, of course. So at that time, he was going through, something was going on. I think he probably had a breakdown. I remember him in the, I remember him in the shed, and he got into making lattice work chairs, and he would work with wicker and make these kind of ornate chairs. And there was about a period of a year where he was utterly off the rails and very, very, very angry all the time. And they would scream and scream at each other. And I think at that time I had lots and lots of problems in school at the time. And I remember walking around the playground being completely, I used to sit with a mantra in my head, poor dad, poor dad, poor dad, poor dad, poor dad. And I used to think that he was going to, something appalling was going to happen, because he was essentially mad, living in the house with somebody who was going mad at the time. And I was walking around in circles with this mantra going around in my head, and I couldn't get it out of my head. It was about an hour. I was on the playground just going round and round in circles. And something incredibly odd was happening to me then. I don't know what it was, but it was, I was very, very fearful, and you know, it was hard. But when I was older, so he built this house in the garden, and my mother left for 7 weeks and took me away with her on holiday for like this huge extended break, where she had to get out of the house and leave him. At the time, this is just after my birthday, where he bought me a cat for my birthday. And they bought me a cat because they knew I wanted a cat, because they thought I was a sensitive child and would like that. And then I loved it. And then a week after we got the cat, my mother grabbed me and we left the home for 7 weeks. This was the time, I think, when my dad was sectioning up the garden in order to plan out this house that he was going to build in the garden. He put the foundations down when she was away. And when I got home, he got rid of the cat. So they bought me a cat for my birthday. And then when I got back, he just got rid of it. And that was it. You know, he didn't even say sorry. It was just the cat was in the way. I couldn't feed it. So I got rid of the cat. And that was my birthday present. And I was looking forward to seven weeks to seeing that cat. But that sounds small. But it's one of a thousand things that was... that's an abnormal thing to do. That's not a normal thing to do in a house. But over the years, I've attempted to kind of say, to normalize this behavior in every which way I can. And I've always thought that everybody had odd relationships with their parents. Everybody hates their parents a bit. Everybody has parents that, you know, when people say that they love you, they don't really kind of, they're just kind of saying it, aren't they? They're saying it because it's the thing that you've got to say or whatever. And over the years, I've kind of realized that that's not true at all. You know, people are genuine. Another thing my dad always says is 95% of people don't know fuck all. That's one of his sayings. Everybody in the world is thick, which is obviously his way of saying everybody in the world is stupid apart from me. I'm the person that's intelligent. I'm the person that knows everything. But anyway, so the house was built, and then we moved again one more time. And that was in my final year of, I don't know what you call it over there. I was 11, so it's before you go to middle school or senior school. We'd call it senior school. And he decided after he built and sold the house in the garden that we were going to move to Wales, which is in rural Wales, so the middle of nowhere in Wales. That was his dream. That's what he wanted to do, and he got that in his mind. My mother said no, she didn't want to go. So he took me, and we moved to Wales, me and him. He just took me, and we went. Just the two of us when I was 11.
And were you scared to death when that happened?
No, because as I said, I was very good at avoiding him. Mm-hmm. And I think I had this is another odd thing about my relationship with him, and another odd thing about, which is just abnormal, you know, in a family context, is that I hated him, you know, from a very, very early age. I hated him. I thought he was a monster. I thought he was a blowhard. I thought he talked shit all the time. I thought that he didn't know what he was talking about. And, you know, he gave me... I don't think I ever sought his approval. I don't think that ever really... I mean, subconsciously, I must have done in some ways. But it wasn't I hated him from a very, very early age. Like you would a stepfather, I suppose, who was horrible to you. I bet he was my proper father, or my actual father, you know, stepfathers, proper fathers, but you know.
So
and he
sorry, oh, sorry so yeah. Here you are, this 11-year-old kid who is in some ways a lot smarter than other kids, because, you know, you've seen all these things and you're surviving every day, where some kids don't have to deal with any of that. And you've altered your behavior, and you are quiet. You make yourself small. You're trying not to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
And those things are going to affect you later on in life, which is going to make your life more difficult in many instances. So when you go with your dad here, You know, who are you as this child that's going? You have any identity at all, like, or interests, or you just like,
no.
You know, is it hard for you to make friends?
I've always had one friend. I've always found it very, very difficult being in groups. I find group dynamics very, very hard. I find the kind of hierarchy of even friendly groups, I find quite difficult. I think my upbringing has made me a very cynical person. It's also made me very, as a positive, I think, very good at spotting people that are talking shit and people who are kind of have narcissistic traits, certainly. I think that's quite common. I can see self-aggrandizement, people that kind of are giving little clues which they think aren't noticeable about how great they are, but are noticeable. I can see them. I think I've got a very good radar for hunting out seeing people who. But anyway, I'm not good in groups. So yes, I was very isolated. And in the last year of my junior school, so when I was 10, I didn't have any friends at all. My one friend who was a year older than me left, and I spent a whole year with no friends in junior school. And I was pretty adrift at that time. It was difficult. But I got through it. I think I was a weird kid. Very, very kind of self-conscious. I went through a period of being very paranoid, walking down the street and thinking people were looking at me. And I was, you know, when I was that sort of age, I was fundamentally probably very, very unhappy and I didn't know who I was. I never have known who I am as a person, and I've never had any real interests. I've never really been able to choose one thing and go down one path, because all paths look the same really to me. And I think that's to do with self-worth. A couple of things going on. I think my subconscious says, if you've chosen to do that, that's not the right thing to do. I think also there's my dad's voice there. But anything that he didn't understand, he would say was shit or was worthless or useless. And look at that idiot doing that thing. Why the fuck is he doing that? He would say literally things like that. Because he didn't understand, or he didn't know what would motivate somebody to do just the most stupid things. I want to also say something about at that time when I was in junior school, when I was from the age of, I've also got ADHD, as I said earlier. So being born and having that extra kind of problem, you know, I have a problem with concentration, and I've got a problem with, I've always thought that my problem with motivation was ADHD related, but recently I've kind of thought that it isn't. It's something else going on there. But it must have been very difficult for me to be, I must have been quite a loud child when I was very much younger and full of energy and full of beans and full of, like, my son has ADHD and he babbles, he makes noise all the time, random exclamations. He's a handful, and he's hard work, you know. And he chooses T-shirts, and he chooses things all the time because he's just absolutely constantly on the go. And I used to do that as well. I used to chew my T-shirts. I used to make funny gurning faces and doing all that sort of stuff. And that must have been an extra reason why he kind of took against me at the time. That must have been quite difficult for me then. But I found it very, very difficult to do anything anyway because of my ADHD. I've got no sticking power, and I lose interest in things very easily. And that, on top of that, pardon me, having this kind of chronic lack of kind of self-esteem and inability to make a choice and just do something, you know. Some people, when they get hobbies, I still don't understand it. It's like, I said, why do you... Why do you do that? Why do you really enjoy doing that? And it's because people try something, they do it for a bit, they find it's good fun, and then they carry on doing it. They just carry on doing it for 10 years. They don't think about doing anything else, but I don't do that. If I started playing the guitar, 2 weeks into playing the guitar, I think, why am I playing the guitar? Am I a guitar playing guy? Is that the person that I am? Why am I doing this? Why haven't I chosen the drums to play? Maybe the drums are a better thing to play. Nobody, who plays the guitar? Let's try drums, you know? And then I'll lose interest in drums. And then that goes as well, you know? Or drawing. Or I never give anything enough time because I've got so many reasons to stop doing things. And I don't have the self-esteem or self-worth to tell myself I'm doing okay at stuff and to tell myself I'm doing good enough. It must have been incredibly hard for me as a child, thinking back as an adult, to exist in that house. And the amount of affection that I didn't get, and the amount of fear that was there. But also, my mother's not an affectionate person. My father is an aggressive person and literally would have directed aggression towards me. I don't know where you get self-esteem from in that environment. I don't know where it comes from. The model that you're supposed to kind of take it from is so screwed up and so hateful that I didn't have any other good male role models. You know, I didn't have any. All of my teachers were female, apart from one who should I say his name?
I'll call him a different name.
Okay, this was years ago anyway. And I thought he was my first and only male teacher, and I absolutely idolized him. And he went away, so I had him for 2 years. With a 1 year gap in between. He went away and then came back. And then in the second week that he'd come back, so I had him for a whole year, then he was gone for a year. And the next year, in the first week that we were back at school, I went back into his class and I was so excited. And I was leaning back and wobbling on my chair because, you know, I had ADHD, but it was never diagnosed then. And my memory of him is he picked me up by the arm and threw me across the room into the door. And it just came back and screamed in my face because I disrupted the lesson. And, God, Jesus Christ, you know, that must have been incredibly difficult for me to deal with at the time. And the first year that he was there, you know, my mother had sent him a letter at the end of the year saying how much I'd enjoyed it. And he'd got this letter when he was away from school. And even then, he decided one of his first actions was to fucking throw me across the room. And I found that just absolutely baffling, you know. I found it really, really difficult. So it was really hard at home. And I had shit like that happening to me. And because I was quiet, I was picked on in school as well. And
so
it was really hard.
So sometimes when you're discussing these things, you say it must have been difficult for me. Do you have issues where you kind of detach yourself from the feelings that were going on at that time?
I can't. I have very little memory, but there has been a constant narrative. We've discussed this from when I was tiny. I've listened to my sister talking about my father, and then eventually I joined in. We were talking about what an arsehole he is. But I have very little memory from that time. I have feeling memories, and, you know, I'm so full of self-doubt, I think, as well, like a lot of people who've grown up in those houses, who are, I'm a kind person. I'm not necessarily a judgmental person. And I try and give my dad constant breaks. So if I don't see him for a while, I'll say, is it as bad? Is it as bad as I remember it was? Is he as shit as I remember him? And, you know, fortunately, and unfortunately, but fortunately, every time I see him, he reconfirms. I mean, he's an arsehole now. So God knows what he was like when he was a 25-year-old. Because he's a... Anyway.
So before we kind of go to parts of when you're older, you know, this is kind of how you're forming now in these years of what's going to happen later. Are you able to articulate how your your sisters are doing, or how their self-esteem and their issues, are they having the same problems kind of going forward?
Well, we've all had a lot of kind of problems, really, our own problems. My oldest half sister drinks too much and has always drank too much. I didn't go a day, I don't think, without a drink for about 25 years. I would drink every day. My sister, who's 6 years older than me, drinks way too much as well. Interestingly, on the nature nurture thing, my half sister is a different sort of person to me and my full middle sister. She is different. She is more kind of closer to narcissistic, I suppose, in her kind of personality attributes than I am, and certainly my other sister is. We are a lot more questioning and kind of we beat ourselves up more. We kind of don't know who we are, I suppose. That's what you would say.
Yeah, so yourself and your two sisters that you grew up with, you all have identity issues.
Yes. Yeah, we all have identity issues. And,
continue.
My oldest sister, so the half-sister, is she – I don't know if she's a narcissist, but she has a very, very strong front. So she's a different person when she's drunk to when she's sober, and she is a storyteller. So she retells the funny things she's done in her life all the time. Like, she is constructing, almost like she's constantly telling herself she's all right. She has these, she goes on long, kind of always the same, and always kind of, she's the hero of the story, or the funny person in the story. The story's always about things that were just the most hilarious things that ever happened. Usually she instigated them. And it used to be, when I was younger, it used to be great because she's full of life and full of kind of fun and outrageous. She's quite an outrageous person. You know, she's always up for a drink and a good time. But the older she's got, it's and the more I've kind of realized that it's a face, and that's not the person that she is. And she does actively construct this every single day. And behind that, there is an emptiness. You know, she doesn't know who she is. She has no personality unless she is actively building it. And that is very similar to my father, but in a different way. She's not in any way cruel. She's not in any way heartless. She does make an overt thing of being caring, though, which is interesting. So it's almost a flip side. She will be the first person to – she'll buy the biggest presents for everybody. She will kind of make a big show of being incredibly kind. And that's the person that she wants to be. Sometimes you kind of see that that's her creation, you know.
And how about your middle?
She is, a bit more like me, a lot more like me, but much more driven to do things. She doesn't have ADHD, and she doesn't have, once she gets her mind set on something, she will see it through to the end. She's just, She became a nurse age 50. We trained. She went and did they wouldn't let her go onto the university course. She wanted to do it in a year, pardon me, but they wouldn't let her do it without a pre-university course that she had to complete in a year. And she did it in a couple of months, you know. She just went in and did all of the work. She just wrote it, aced it, and they let her on in the September, let her onto the course. So in the space of about 15 months, she'd done full nurse. Was it? Or was it 2 years? I can't remember. Anyway, she did it in this incredibly short period of time, and she aced it. I'm not like that at all. But she also has problems with, she'll get bored of that, I think. And she'll decide that that's not the thing she wants to be, and she'll go and try and do something else. And there's been 1,000 things like that in her life. She lived in the Caribbean for a long time because she kind of ran away a bit and kind of left England and needed to go and have a big adventure somewhere. And then when she moved back, she stayed here for a year and then moved to live in the Med on an island. She lived there for 8 years or 9 years. It's a kind of a running away narrative, I suppose.
I mean, we could probably go into the later years of your high school and discuss all of the other kind of extra things that would have happened, but it seems it's best probably right here to, I guess, now discuss your adopted out sister as far as, you know, because we were discussing your all of your issues. So, you know, when you're 42 years old.
Yeah.
You get a phone call from your middle sister.
That's right, yeah. And she said, yeah, somebody has got in contact with me on Facebook, and she is saying that she's might be related to us, and could this possibly be true? Take a look at her Facebook profile. So we both had a look together when we were on the phone, and it was instantly, I mean, it was just, there's no way she was telling the truth, you know? But when you're 42 and that happens, and, it was just unreal. It's not something that happens. You know, it happens that people discover they've had, their parents had children from previous marriages that kind of turn up. But it's very, very unusual that a full sister, especially one who is kind of slots in the middle, turns up. They're usually older, aren't they? By significant amount.
And it's unusual because your eldest half sister, who was around at the time, had no idea.
No idea at all.
Yeah.
Neither of us had, none of us had any idea at all. And we saw her picture. She was so obviously like my middle sister. I mean, she just is virtually identical. They are so, so similar in face. And they would have been, if they'd have grown up together, 3 years apart. So they would have been, you know, compadres. They would have been friends or not, but would have been very close. Whether best friends or best enemies, I don't know how that works with close siblings. But and then she, we confronted my parents. I didn't confront my parents. My middle sister did, and said, "Is this true?" And my mother denied it to start with. She said, "No, it's not true." And then when it very, very quickly in the phone call, I think, became clear that there was no way she was going to get out of it, she just went very quiet on the phone and then eventually said, yes, it is true. But dealt with it in just the worst way. They both dealt with it very, very badly. We were ever going to tell us that she was this person existed, and they both said just straight out, no, we were never going to tell you. We didn't think we needed to tell you. It's not something. It's not none of your business. Basically, is what they said, which fits perfectly because, you know, the family revolves around my father, always has, and it's my mother and my father on one side, and the children on the other side. It's not. They're not at the top, and we are underneath them. They are separated from us. And, you know, well, I suppose my mother and the kids orbit the dad, orbit my father, but my mum and dad are a closed unit. And we all were encouraged to get out of the house as quickly as possible when we were kids. We were all very much made to feel that we were a burden on my dad, and what he wanted to do with his life was being stymied by our existence, basically. And that sounds like I'm overstating it, but I'm really not. He made it very, very clear that that it was something that was stopping him being the wonderful, successful person that he inevitably should have been, was having us around. And anyway, so when she came back onto the scene, the adopted out sister, it was obviously an incredibly hard situation for them to deal with, because so they went into this big narrative about how they had, every year on her birthday, we thought about her and wondered what she's doing. You know, we've always worried that she was, you know, whether she was alive and if she'd had a good life. And then this woman turns up, this grown woman, and they don't really want much to do with their own children. And now they've got, one that got away, has come back. And of course, my dad is terrified that this person wants something from him that he's incapable of giving anybody. You know, he's got nothing to give anybody else apart from himself. He's just a fundamentally selfish human being. And so, you know, eventually she came over and saw them, and I asked her what it was like meeting them for the first time and all that sort of stuff. And she said it was very emotional meeting my mother, and my mum was very nervous about seeing her. But then she said my father just talked about himself for an hour. So she walked into the room, this baby that he'd given up, and this 50-something-year-old baby had just walked in and sat down in front of him. And instead of asking her about her life, he just talked about himself and how great he is, all the things he's done and how much money he's made and all of those sort of things. And again, that sounds like I'm overstating it, but I'm not. That's literally what he would have done. He would have sat there and said, you know, I'm a very successful person. I've managed to make a lot of cash in my life. You know, this sort of, oh, Jesus. But yeah, so there was that. And then both of them don't feel like they owe us anything, any explanation, any kind of, you know, nothing, no apology. I mean, I don't want an apology from them, but we understand. They keep trying to turn it back to the fact that it was so difficult for them when they were teenagers, and saying, you kids just don't understand how hard it was. And we keep saying to them, there is no blame. We all totally understand that it was very, very difficult for you then. And we don't blame you at all for that. It's a completely reasonable thing to have done if you were under pressure, you know, completely different times. The social pressure must have been enormous. We're empathetic human beings and we understand that. And no matter how much we say it, they keep bringing it back to that, because they can't, especially my dad, he can't imagine that he's got anything else to do apart from to kind of, that's the only thing that he can think that he did in this entire situation that needs apologizing for. He doesn't owe us an explanation. He doesn't owe us anything, because that is how he perceives us and his kids. You know, he would never sit down and kind of say, if you've got questions about this, or attempt some sort of healing, or all of that thing would be utterly alien to him. He just would never do it. And in fact, the opposite is true. In the time that he came to see me and we sat down and talked about this for an hour or 2 hours in the pub, he was actively antagonistic towards me, kind of saying, what do you want me to say? You know, you don't know how difficult it is for me. and just didn't let me say anything. The moment he got uncomfortable with the things that I was saying and started to kind of suggest to him that he might want to talk more openly to me, he starts getting aggressive and angry. So I've come to totally accept that now. I think I accepted that in my 20s, that I'm never going to get anything from him. And that's one thing that this whole situation and having a father like him has done, as I think I've spent my life self-analyzing, and I think I've done quite a good, relatively good job at it, really.
You've done a very good job.
I think I've read a lot of stuff, and been through a lot of shit. You know, I was depressed for many years, and I was kind of on welfare for a long time. And I never, even though I'm probably am an alcoholic, I don't drink that much anymore. And I managed to pull it back. And I think a lot of people, I was listening to Pierre on one of your older podcasts, and he said something about drugs being lots of people in my, and I've always thought this, you know, I'm such a, in so many ways, so utterly useless. You know, I have a learned helplessness, like you said to Pierre, and also I am neurotic. I'm utterly introspective. I am totally avoidant. I am avoidant of doing anything. You know, it takes me, just to ridiculous extent. I had to change the settings on the boiler a couple of years ago. I had to set the timer so that it came on at certain times. It took me a year to do it. it's ridiculous. Even saying it. I used to sit there, but if it involves people, if it involves going up to somebody, any situation that might involve conflict, judgment, hierarchy, where somebody is above me, so anything that involves any sort of fucking work, basically, anything that involves, I used to driving. I passed my driving test in my 30s, my early 30s. I didn't drive for 10 years. And I used to have panic attacks in the car. And I realized eventually wasn't to do with the act of driving, although I do have ADHD and I find it difficult. I get kind of, concentration is hard for me, but not that hard. And, I realized it was because I was terrified of breaking down and blocking the road and having people be angry with me who were behind me and having to ask for help of people to push the car off the road. What would happen if a tire burst and I crashed in someone's house? They'd be so angry with me. What would happen if the car broke down in the middle of the road? And I had 30 cars behind me all honking their horns. Jesus Christ, what would I do? Literally, that's what I was frightened of, you know. It's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous.
So while you're dealing with all these things still, I just want to go back to your sister, your adopted sister for 1 second.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, when you spoke to her and, you know, you've now known her for 3 years, not well. Yeah. I mean, you don't have that much communication with her. No. But, you know, from your perspective, how is her life in comparison to you and the siblings that you grew up with?
Well, I think from what I know and from what I can kind of intuit from speaking to her and talking to her on the phone and stuff. And also we went to Amsterdam for a while together. All of the sisters, we went and spent 3 nights there. And she's successful. She's single-minded. These are things that I can definitely say about her, I think. She's done the same thing for a long time. So she's worked in the same profession from her 20s. One thing she has done is moved, you know, which is a big thing that we kind of have done. She ran away from England and she lives in Canada. She is very well known in her field, I think. I think I could say that. And is very kind of active in engaging with people and getting herself out there. I think she knows her mind. She's very able to say no to people. I think she is. One thing that we definitely have learned to do from my father. A lot of people with narcissistic parents say that as children they were kind of forced to, not necessarily forced, but they felt the urge to perform and be the best at things, like my sister probably did when she was young. You know, she rejected that when she was 15, 16, when she kind of realized that it was for the birds. It wasn't going to get her anywhere with her dad, I suppose. But one thing that I never did that. I never, ever tried to perform and be great, because I don't think I ever wanted to, I can't remember ever wanting his praise and wanting to be in his shining, you know, have him shine his light on me. But one thing that always used to help to kind of get rid of his rage and calmed him down used to be making him laugh. So one thing that we did in our family was laugh all the time. So from an external point of view, my dad is a very intelligent man. You know, which is a total paradox. He is incredibly well read. I mean, he's ill-educated. Sounds like I'm putting him down, but I don't want to do that. He didn't have a good education at all. He left school at 14, but he's an intelligent person. He reads incredibly widely. Fiction and non-fiction as well. And also, he's a member of Mensa. He does the crossword, very hard crossword in this country. Is it very hard? It's a cryptic crossword anyway. The Times crossword every Sunday. He's incredibly proud that he can do it. So he'll obviously incredibly demonstrative that he's done it. But one thing that is guaranteed is making him laugh. So our house was filled with jokes, wordplay, puns, stupid jokes, fart jokes, any sort of jokes. And that was the currency of the house, you know. That was how we had any sort of bonding together, was with him especially, was in the kind of love of jokes and humor. We used to watch comedy programs together all the time. It also led to kind of a situation in which it was just extraordinary that we would make jokes about everything, you know, because he's got no empathy. Everything is fair game. So we were never serious. And jokes are constantly used in our house to deflect from when situations called for empathy and kindness. And love and cuddles and hugs and being close to your kids, it would be replaced with wry jokes and kind of deflection using humor, I suppose. Anyway, I've lost my train of thought now, Brandon.
Well, let's move into then, now that you are a dad.
Oh, yeah.
And so you're a dad now. You have your own children.
Yes, I've
and,
got two kids.
You know, everyone who's listening should know that you still speak to your dad. You still see your dad. You still see your mom. So let's talk about, like, how you started to parent yourself, the things you started to notice about that, about yourself, and then how you deal with your dad going forward and how they interact, your children interact with him.
Yeah. Well, before I had kids, I saw my parents less and less and less and less and less. So when I left home when I was 18, I didn't see them I saw them twice in 2 years. So I was kind of thrown out of home at 18 and I had to find something to do. But I saw them twice, and that was absolutely fine with them. My mother and father never phoned me. I never phoned them. It was that was just basically how it appeared that they wanted it to be. I'm sure my mother didn't want that, but it must have been hard for her. And she used to come and see me and give me £20 notes And she still does it to this day. I'm 45 years old. She will give me money to buy things, like for the kids, for the grandchildren. And she will slip it to me like she's giving me a tip so that he doesn't see. Or she'll wait until he's got in the car and she'll come back and she'll do it. Because if she sees him, if he sees her giving me money, she'll get shit. So she can't even show that affection for us even now, which is just so fucking tragic. And it's just... Anyway, but when my own children... So I didn't see them for a long time. It was kind of getting less and less and less. And I had a couple of gigantic blow-ups with my dad. I mean, just, I'm the sort of person that keeps it in, keeps it in, keeps it in. I'll take it on the chin, take it on the chin, and then suddenly something will happen. It's usually when my father is talking crap and I'm sitting there listening to him self-aggrandizing and saying how great he is. But then he will change tack and he will attempt to elicit from me sympathy about how hard done by he is. And that is generally the trigger for me. So I will be sitting there listening to him for hours, talking about himself and saying how great he is. But then suddenly he will say something like, I don't know, I can't give you an example. But he'll want me to say, a moment will come in the conversation where I'm expected to say, yes, you're really great, Dad. You really had a hard time there. I just can't do it. And usually, and it has happened twice, that those usually with drink, when I've been drinking, but usually at those moments, it just goes. I mean, you can't imagine, just huge. I've almost had, both times we've been pulled apart by my mother, fist fights, almost fist fights, and just the most incredible rage. But the last time, you know, he's quite an old guy now. I think he was 70 at the time. And I don't know if your listeners will kind of appreciate it, but the rage that is inside me is just gigantic. And that comes from somewhere that is not in my conscious mind. It is somewhere very, very, very deep inside me that I've kind of swallowed down. And it is just so powerful, terrifyingly powerful. And, you know, anyway, but when my children were born, I was forced into a situation. I'd never actively avoided them, but it just so happened that they didn't particularly want to see me. Because my dad doesn't want to, so my mother doesn't, if you know what I mean. My dad doesn't care, so my mother is forced into a situation where she doesn't care. But now that they've got grandchildren, there's now an opportunity for, I've got to make them the kids available to see him, especially for my mother's sake. And a lot of people say that when you have children, you realize how hard it was for your own parents and you have sympathy for them. And a complete and utter fucking opposite thing has happened to me. Completely and utterly the opposite. When I had kids, I realized how appallingly bad a father my father was and how relatively easy it is as a half-functioning human being to give your child affection, to care about what they do on a day-to-day basis, to love them, to tell you love them, to cuddle them, to attempt to feel guilty when you're not spending enough time with them. I constantly think of his welfare and my daughter's welfare, and I worry about what they're going to do when they grow up. I worry about the people that they're going to be. I worry whether my son is going to be, you know, not successful, but happy. All of these things, every single day, they go through my mind. And when he was born 9 years ago, over time, of course, I realized none of that was there when I was a child. Absolutely none of it was there. And I got none of it from my own father. No affection, no cuddles, no hugs. I got aggression and violent rage and never, ever, ever any sort of show of love that wasn't related to him. He would say I'd done something good if it made him look good. If he, and he still does that to this day now. The only things you get, he constantly repeats, you can see him thinking about things that he did. And then he will ask me questions about the thing that he did in order to get me to say that he was great when he did it. So he built me a bed once when I was about 16. He built me a bunk bed in the basement of the house that we lived in. And he probably mentioned about 500 times that bunk bed. And he will say, do you remember that bunk bed that I built you when you were 16? That was a great bed, wasn't it? You really liked that bed, didn't you? And he just wants me to go, yeah, Dad, that was great. Thank you for building that bed for me. It was a brilliant thing that you did there. Of course, that's what I do. And what else? And when we moved to when he moved me to Wales when I was 11, when I moved there with him, that was a train that died. But he kind of, we arrived in Wales at the day before I started school. And he, in the rain, in the dark, it was nighttime, went to bed in the house. I'd never been in the house before in my life. He'd bought the house. First time I'd ever been in there was the Sunday before school started on the Monday. And I got up in the morning at 7 a.m. He gave me my school uniform, pushed me out the door. I got on the bus and went to school in a completely different country, essentially. No build, nothing, no prep. Didn't know where I was going. But anyway, he said I hated it. And I hated every moment of it for the first 4 years I was there. I resented being there. I hated living with him. My mother eventually arrived about a year and a half later. But I spent a year and a half living with him literally in the middle of nowhere in the wilderness in Wales, in a village. And he constantly says to me, because he thinks of that time of his life favorably, and he knows how much I hate it, it gives him a bad feeling when he thinks about it, because it doesn't work with his idea of what he did at that time, that I didn't like it. So he's probably said to me 10,000 times, you loved it in Wales, didn't you? Didn't you love it? You absolutely loved it when you moved there. You loved it, didn't you? And he's just confirming it for his own kind of, he doesn't care that I loved it or not, you know, he doesn't care. He wants me to say, yes, I loved it, Dad. You were great. You're great. What a great person you are doing that massive thing that nobody else would have done, moving their child. I don't do it, of course. I don't give it to him. But then he just forgets. He won't. And they'll ask me again the next time I see him. He's got the same about five questions that he asked me, which must be moments in my life that he struggles with, you know. But anyway, my kids, it is very difficult because he craves their attention in the way that seeing him with them, my children, is what it must have been like for me as a child. And it's very obvious how difficult it would have been. And it gives me a kind of insight into the past, really. And he doesn't allow them any room. He's only openly affectionate in ways that he can kind of handle, which is kind of rough play. So he'll wind them up and wrestle for maybe 2 or 3 minutes, but then gets bored like a 7-year-old himself would, decides to read the paper, will pick up the paper. And the kids, of course, have been wound up and they're not going to calm down for another 40 minutes. But then he gets annoyed with them, even though he's just wound them up to the state of, and my mum and then me and whoever else is there, because we have been programmed over the years to fear his rage and fear his aggression, fear his kind of irritation. We then have to move the children out of the room and out of his space. And even if he's not seen them for 6 months, the same thing will happen every time. He gets bored within about 20 minutes of them. And when he realizes that they can't give him what he wants, yeah, he will have an idealized view. Sorry, I'm touching my ear thing. I hope it's okay. He has an idealized view of what they're going to be like when they come through the door. Granddad, we love you. You're the best, Granddad. And when they don't do it, or when they go to my mother first, you can see him visibly bristle with that. And so it is really, really hard. It's incredibly difficult to be in a small, they live in a flat, in a tiny space. And I've got, my son has ADHD and my daughter is an absolute dynamo. She will just keep moving for hours. And to be in that tiny space with them and see him visibly irritated is incredibly triggering for me. I find it very, very difficult. And I'm sorry, yeah.
Oh, no. So I really want to ask you, so, you know, you're getting triggered in those situations. You have your kids. Mm. I've never talked to you about your wife, even in our pre-call. So yeah. When it comes to your wife, how does your wife – first of all, you got married. And,
Jesus Christ, Jim. That is the – that's – my children are, without shadow of a doubt, the single most incredible thing that I – if you'd have told me that I would have been able to get married and have kids when I was in my 20s or teens, I would have just laughed at you. I would never have thought it was going to happen.
Yeah, so how does someone who has very low self-esteem and all these issues get into a healthy relationship with someone which, you know, for the most part, might have seemed impossible? How does that happen, and how is your relationship with your wife?
It's okay. It's good. It's good. She's very different from me, and I think that's why it works. She is very understanding. She is very tolerant of my parents. You know, what a lot of people do when you talk to them, I've had this problem for a long time. I've always assumed, like I said earlier, I assumed that everybody's parents weren't like mine, but I thought that everybody had problems with their parents or spoke about their parents in certain ways. And I can't tell you the amount of times that I've said to people, oh, God, I hate my dad. I hate my father. I actually dislike him. He's not a nice man. People are shocked. You know, they don't have the headspace to deal with it, because it's out of – often people just don't get it. They think you can't mean that, because they think the only thing that they think of when they think of their parents are their own mum and dad, who, despite their faults and despite them being irritating old right wing stick in the muds, they are generally loving. Dad's a bit weird, but you know, they have an idea about their parents that they generally love them and they're okay. But like when I started talking about this to my wife, I think she just thought I was a bit loopy, you know. But when she met them, and eventually she kind of realized how it is intolerable, and it's very, very, very difficult for me. And he comes round. He'll never come round for more than him and my mum will come around for more than a couple of days. I said this to you before, I think, Brandon, but she can't go anywhere on her own. She can't see the grandchildren on her own without him. And he won't let her. He won't let her come and see us without him, because the thought of her being anywhere without him is it just won't happen. He doesn't allow it. If he goes away, which he does frequently, not frequently, about once a year, he'll go away for a few weeks on his own. He can go away on his own, but she can't. He'll leave. Then she can come, and I have to do a surreptitious phone call to her, and then she can come down for 2 or 3 days. My mum can come down for 2 or 3 days on her own. But otherwise, it's impossible, because he has her on a leash, you know. And even to see her own grandchildren. And he said to her, it's odd for a grandmother to want to see her grandchildren on her own. It's odd. That's a strange thing to want. And that's the kind of gaslighting shit she's been dealing with for 50 years. And she's kind of down the rabbit hole now a bit as well. She doesn't see it anymore. And it's infuriating, but she doesn't think it is strange. And also what happened, one other thing I wanted to say about this before I talk about something else. If I phoned her the other day, I can't phone her phone. Because if he sees that I phoned her, that's not good. That is a kind of, you know, he will see that, and there'll be some sort of pushback from him because of the jealousy that we are favoring her over him. What frequently happens is I will phone my mother. She won't pick up, and then my dad will phone me about 2 minutes later. And I'll just have a conversation with him So he will snipe that time, take that time, nick it from her, and have absolutely no problem with doing that. He doesn't even think twice about doing that. So even though I phone my mother, he is almost saying in those conversations, I know what you're doing. He doesn't actually say, of course, but by phoning me, he's kind of indicating, you phoned your mother, I'm phoning you. What are you doing? Don't think it. And she will frequently, what she used to do as well, is she used to, when I phoned her, or when anybody phoned her, he would pick up the other phone. He would walk upstairs and pick up the phone in the upstairs bedroom. So I could never speak to my mother on her own, ever. It was always a dual conversation or nothing, because he would just totally police what was being said. And that happened for many years. He does it less now, but he still does it occasionally. And my mum is in such a place now in her relationship with him that what she sometimes does when he's in the room is she just puts it on speakerphone. But even if you want to have a private conversation with her, because it's intolerable for her to sit there with him glaring at her or giving her the evil eye.
So for you going forward from, you know, this point out, you're still seeing your family.
Yeah.
And what are the things that you want to work on yourself kind of going forward, as far as, you know, self-worth, learned helplessness and things along those lines, or other things that we didn't touch upon?
Oh, it's very, very hard. I think that the realization, I've struggled my entire life with so many things. And getting an ADHD diagnosis really, really helped me about 2 years ago. That was one part of the puzzle, yeah, to do with just the difficulties that I had in school, why my kind of educational path collapsed so readily when I was 16, 17. I eventually did go to university and get a degree, but it took a long time. It took two failed. I had to do what's called an access course, which is, I suppose it's like an access to university course, which you probably have in there as well. I did two. I failed the first one and then eventually did the second one, but I didn't fail it because I couldn't do the work. I didn't fail it because I didn't understand the work. I failed it because I just couldn't do it. I struggled to write essays. It's one of the hardest things I do. But what I've always had, and what has always been under the surface with me since I was a very small child, was a sense that my father was full of shit, and that has kept me kind of sane, because I think that I always knew that in some small way that I was right. He never managed to kind of get in there with me, which is good. But finding out about narcissism and finding out about because what I've always thought is that he is an 8-year-old boy in a man's body because of the things that happened to him when he was a child. But what I've never, that's never been good enough for me, because it's not a proper explanation. And finding out about narcissism and how, I mean, it just fits like a glove. It's just everything. It just so explains him. It's been huge for me. It really has. It's just, honestly, not in the in my conscious mind, but in my unconscious, something has changed that I have not been able to change for my entire life. It's given me an explanation, and I think what's happened is it's given me an opportunity to stop beating myself up, because finally somebody has said, well, not somebody, but I found out that it's not your fault. All of the things that you think happened. You're not nuts. You're not being cruel to your father by labeling him and seeing these things in him which don't exist. You stop second-guessing myself so much, and it's kind of flipped it. I called this when I was tiny. and I knew what I had the measure of the man for such a long time. It's given me a lot of, and I've always thought of myself as a very empathetic person and a very, as I said before, I think I can read people very well. And I think that is due to my upbringing, you know. I've always been very cynical as well, which is another, in knowing that adults can say one thing but mean something else or present as one way and be utterly repulsive behind closed doors, I've known since I was 5 or 6 years old. And that's a very strange thing to know when you're a little child and to kind of understand. But in another way, it's very good for your kind of emotional intelligence, I suppose. Support for your kind of core emotional intelligence, I think I'm very, very good at that. I understand people. I understand that people are flawed. I understand that, I understand people very well, I think. But going forwards, I think I'm going to get therapy. That's the short answer. I'm going to try. I don't have the money, but I'm going to try. I'm going to try some way to get some sort of therapy. I don't know what kind yet, so we have to see.
And as far as, you know, giving words of wisdom or advice for other people that are going through the same thing as you or have been through the same thing as you, what do you have to say to them?
It would depend on the stage of life that you're in. For people that are listening to this who are adults, I would say you don't owe your parents anything if they've given you a bad time when you were a child. The bonds of love which you think should exist and which you kind of yearn for and romanticize like we all do, they're never going to be there. And it sounds like I don't think personally you are chasing rainbows if you think that the person who has been the kind of the center of the neutron star dragging all of this kind of, in my family, he's the, you know, the locus of all of this chaos with these kind of, we've all kind of orbited him our entire lives. If you think that's going to change, I don't think you can change a person like that. You will not, I don't think you will get what you want. You need to work on, that is the fundamental thing that one has to learn and come to terms with and try to be at peace with, is the fact that it's not you, it's them, and resentment is okay. You don't need to appease them. The things that you want are okay, and you don't need to be made to feel guilty. Don't try and seek love and the thing that was missing when you were a child, because down that road that's a very, very difficult road, and that will prevent you from making real progress, basically. And I think that's something that I realized relatively young. And I think that helped me at the time, basically, yeah. And keep going. Try to believe that your story is real and true, because it is. It's most of the time it is. You're in the right, and parents can be arseholes, and arseholes have children, and you know, the world is filled with so many unkind, selfish people that just when you have kids, it doesn't just suddenly appear. Compassion, understanding, love, the ability to love doesn't just suddenly be magically beamed into the heart of people because they have kids. Yeah. So it's not your fault. It's their fault. that would be my message.
Well, Simon, you did it. You were really nervous to do this episode, and you did it, and you did a great job. And so many people are going to learn from your story. It was educational. It was emotional. And how are you feeling right now that it's we're almost done here?
I can't remember anything that I said.
It's a good. Well, guess what? It was recorded, so you can listen to it all you want.
Good. Okay, good. Well, I'm glad. Good. Wow. I mean, there's a billion things I could have said, but it's very, very good to have come on and said it. It's interesting because as soon as I heard a couple of them, I just thought I have to get in contact with you to get on because it was these sort of podcasts are rare. These kind of stories. And it's one thing that I definitely tried to seek out and kind of came up blank a lot of the time. There's a lot of self-help stuff out there, which is good, but it's kind of like, and there's also a lot of stuff which is not coming from kind of therapist-led, if you know what I mean, mm-hmm. rather than people just talking and telling their story. And this is much better. It's much better for people to tell their own stories. This is how I see it, rather than being constantly there's a lot of ones which are kind of stop all the time where people go, oh, this must have been, you know, it must have been incredibly hard for you, and taking people off track in order to kind of make them emote more than they should, because it's your story, you tell it. It's and that is very powerful, because it's powerful for me to hear that so many other people have had the same experience as me, and yeah, in their voice, it's good. We're very glad I did it.
Well, I'm happy you did it. And what other people don't know, there's one thing we do share in common, which is I'm going to do some little joke here. We do have the same hairstyle.
Yeah.
And we have the same shaped head to a T. So I'm sure from the back, you would think we might be the same person.
Yes, but you're not my brother, are you, Brandon?
I am in Canada. You never know. You never know. So I really, from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for being here today, Simon. It was a pleasure talking to you and getting to know you and your story. So from the bottom of my heart, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me on.
You're welcome. And for everyone else who is listening, I hope you have a good night.